Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Forum for Philosophy. Subscribe for weekly discussions of science, culture, politics, and the arts from a philosophical perspective. The Forum is a non-profit organization, and our events are free and open to all. You can support our work via our website and Facebook page.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the LSE. Welcome to this Forum event on the theme of Imagination in Science, co-sponsored by the LSE Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science. We tend to think of science as a rather dry, serious business, you know, number crunching, data analysis, graphs, submitting papers to journals, responding to reviewers. But we know from looking at the history of science that it's certainly not always like that. It's not always dry and serious. Throughout the history of science, often the greatest breakthroughs come from these moments of extraordinary insight, imagination, creativity, where a scientist just has a kind of vision of a way the world could be. And in moments like these, science sometimes seems more like art, and the scientists sometimes seem more like artists. This raises some really interesting questions about how science works. Now, it raises questions like, what is a thought experiment? How can there be such a thing as a thought experiment? How do thought experiments differ from real experiments, and why are they so important in science? Is imagination in science the same thing as imagination in the arts and in literature? Or is it something fundamentally different from that? And how has the scientific imagination changed over time? Has it always been the same? Is it some kind of innate human capacity? Or is it something learned? Can imaginations be trained? And is it a skill that has been taught differently across time? So it's a pleasure to be joined by experts from across the history and philosophy of science who have all really interesting perspectives to bring to bear on some of these questions. They are Stephen French and Alice Murphy from the University of Leeds and Melanie Keane from the University of Cambridge. What we'll do is we'll talk a bit amongst the panel, and then at various points during the discussion we'll invite questions from you. So do be thinking of the sort of things you'd like to ask the panel as we go on. But let's start with you, Alice. Why is it that people do tend to think of science as something in which the imagination really isn't a big part? Where does this come from?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. Well, I'm sure there's plenty of reasons, but definitely one that's quite a commonplace reason and one that's perhaps more a theoretical reason and one that philosophers have spoken about. So firstly, I think we commonly, as you mentioned, associate the imagination with creativity, and the imagination allows us to look beyond the world as it is and to explore other worlds. So through the imagination, we escape the real world, whether this is in our engagement with fiction, such as novels or plays, or when we're children playing games of make-believe and pretense. And so through the imagination, we can look beyond how things are. And the imagination is seen as essential in the domain of art. We value artists and their abilities to conjure up new ideas and make great works. So the imagination takes us beyond the world as it is, and this is part of why we value it so highly. So that might be the more commonplace reason. There's also been theoretical reasons that philosophers of mind have spoken about. But firstly, it might be worth saying that it's not as if that kind type of creative activity isn't important in science. We can allow that the imagination plays a crucial role in scientists coming up with innovative theories and ideas. The imagination has a part to play in what's often called the context of discovery of scientific hypotheses. But many have thought that it might be limited to this, so the imagination has no place in the context of justification. So, sure, I can conjure up different theories and ideas about the world in my imagination, but these need to be tested in order for me to say that they're true or that they're likely to occur, in the same sense that we could happily fantasize about, winning the World Cup, but that doesn't mean that it's actually going to happen for me. So the thought there is then that even if the imagination is essential for me coming up with new theories, these ultimately have to be assessed before we can say that they're justified, so before we can say that they're true. But to move on to the more philosophical reasons, the imagination has often been regarded as voluntary, so there's a certain freedom to our imagination. So I might not be able to imagine whatever I want, but I am free to imagine things that I know are not the case. So if I wanted to, I could happily imagine that right now there's a giant pink elephant stood behind me. And this differs from perception, right? So it makes no sense to say that I can choose to perceive a giant elephant behind me, and perception is reality orientated. And similarly with belief, and belief, at least when it's working properly, is evidence sensitive. So I can't choose to believe that there's a pink elephant stood behind me. So another reason then to be skeptical about the imagination's place in learning is that we're free to a certain extent at least to imagine what we want to imagine. So we might worry that the imagination's just not in the business of providing us with knowledge.
Yeah, there's a kind of wishful thinking, right? Yeah. So the skeptical view there, I mean, you've articulated this thought that imagination really doesn't have a role in the serious business of science, right? That the serious business is about trying to test hypotheses, justify certain kinds of claims, achieve knowledge. And there's this skeptical view that imagination doesn't have any real role in those kind of serious processes.
Yeah.
But I mean, you think that in the end that's wrong.
Yeah, I do. So I think this is where it's nice to think about the use of thought experiments in science, because these are cases where scientists have directly appealed to their imaginations in order to gain new insights about the world. So these might be a nice case for thinking about, well, if we can constrain and guide our imagination in the right type of way, actually we can get something very fruitful out of it.
Can you give an example of the sort of thing you think?
Yeah, sure. So, Galileo and Einstein were both very famous thought experimenters or imaginers. Let's take a case from Galileo first. And this is one of the most famous scientific cases, I think. So Galileo used thought experiments to undermine Aristotle's physics. And this case begins by considering Aristotle's theory that heavier bodies fall faster than lighter ones. So Galileo asked us to imagine dropping a heavy ball and a light ball from, it's usually depicted as being from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. So according to Aristotle's theory, the heavier body...
It's a thought experiment. It can be wherever you like.
Yes.
Sure.
Any tower.
But you can't go wherever you want, right, with a thought experiment. There's certain things that have got to be in place. But sure, whatever tower you want or whatever height you want, yeah, and whatever coloured balls you want. But there's certain things that have to be constrained. So according to Aristotle's theory, the heavy ball's going to fall faster than the lighter one. But then Galileo says, well, if we imagine attaching the two balls together, then Aristotle's theory leads us to a contradiction, because it states both that the compound object, the heavy body plus the light body together, is going to fall faster because it's heavier than the heavy body on its own. But it also states that the composite object is going to fall slower because the lighter ball is going to slow down the heavier one. So we get a contradiction.
Right, so there's just no way to make sense of what happens when the two balls touch each other.
Well, that's Galileo's claim, and that's what the thought experiment's meant to show, is that Aristotle's theory leads us to a contradiction in that case, and therefore it has to be rejected.
And the Galileo views then?
Carry
on falling at the same speed.
Exactly, right? Yeah, no matter what the weight.
So the idea is, you know, that's actually providing evidence. Is that the thought that, you know, we thought the Aristotelian view is a serious possibility, and then we thought about what does this theory say about what happens when the two balls touch? And the thought experiment tells us the theory can't be right.
Yeah.
And that Galileo's theory must be right, without having to ever actually drop any balls off any actual
tower. So the imaginative activity is meant to have evidential significance alone. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, let's bring in Stephen and Melanie on this. I mean,
And I think it is really important that it was the Leaning Tower of Pisa, because one thing I think we see in quite a lot of this imaginative work is that it stretches beyond what we know, but not that far. Often in our imagination we combine, in a sort of dreamlike way actually, elements which in the real world are not seen together, whether that's the colour of an elephant not being what we would normally find if we were to go along to London Zoo, but there are things which nevertheless are drawn from our sense experience, from what we already know that are familiar to us, and thought experience a way of reconfiguring that knowledge in a creative and I think often very productive manner, but often it's not so much of a leap of the imagination that it has no relation back to
even
the real
world. He didn't actually drop them from
there. No, exactly.
But
he
story,
could have.
He could have, and the story works for people because we know what the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and people at that time would have known what the Leaning Tower of Pisa was.
Yeah, and I think that's often how thought experiments work, right? They relate theories that are complex and hard to understand to stuff that we can get because we've had experiences with similar objects before.
Yeah, so it's our experience of actually seeing real objects falling from the sky at various points in our lives that allows us to do this imaginative exercise and see that the Aristotelian view can't be right, even if we previously thought it was.
Yeah.
I mean, could you argue that really the evidence is coming from all the experiences, all the past experiences that are implicitly being funneled into this thought experiment?
Right, so it's not actually the imagination that's playing that kind of...
Could that be right? You know, if you wanted to defend the view that in the end all evidence comes from experience, not from imagination.
Sure, but I think it's the imagination that's drawing out these kind of this tacit knowledge that we already had.
And doesn't it act as like it's the arena in which this takes place? So it allows us, you know, by virtue of being what it is, it allowed Galileo to. Okay, you had the Tower of Pisa, but he didn't say this Tower of Pisa and there were birds and it was a pretty day and, you know, someone was serving pizza near Pisa, and he didn't have to mention all that. He could extract just you have a tower, the two balls falling, and it was the imagination that allows him to do that, to make these kinds of moves that allow you to focus on what for him was important.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting we're talking about Galileo and this early modern example of a thought experiment, because I think there's lots of connections here to the rise of experimental natural philosophy and similar discussions about whether something which was taking place in an artificial situation, either something that had been constructed, nature had been, you know, had its tail twisted in the Baconian phrase, but again, whether that counted as everyday sense knowledge or whether it was something which was only exceptionally produced in these extreme situations or with the intervention of new pieces of technology. And I think there's an analogue to whether that counts as real knowledge about nature in an actual experiment.
Because you're isolating the phenomenon. You're in the lab. That's what they had to learn to do, was to isolate. And that's what you're able to do with the imagination. You're able to isolate what's important.
I mean, and then it's really interesting to draw out the difference, which is that an important tenet then of experimentation becomes replication.
Yes.
And even though your initial report says on Wednesday afternoon we evacuated all the air out of this air pump, someone else on the other side of Europe can do the same thing.
Yeah.
And again, we're coming back to these ideas that becomes such a crucial role of what experimental science is defined by.
Yeah.
Can you replicate a thought experiment?
I think so, yeah, I think so. You can ask a wide variety of people. And thought experiments can be assessed. I think you can.
So just that, you know, if you replicate a thought experiment by getting lots of people to do that imaginative exercise, you think that that's then more evidence, in the same way that replicating a real experiment gives you more evidence?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not too sure.
But isn't that what Galileo does? Well, he publishes his thought experiment in the book, right, in the dialogues. Loads of people read it, right? And there's no Aristotelian, well, I don't know, I'm not a historian, so maybe there was, but, you know, was there any Aristotelian who said, hang on a minute, I think that's wrong, you know, I can imagine, I don't think that happened.
And what's quite nice about the way that Galileo presents this is that he does have the Aristotelian character, right, in the dialogues, who is the one who might come along and think, well, hang on.
Yeah, but isn't he the stupid one?
He is the stupid one.
I think it's really interesting, being the publishing, I would argue that, in fact, much replication of actual experiments takes place as thought experiments in the minds of people reading experimental write-ups.
Yeah.
Very few people outside of sort of university laboratory settings nowadays, and even fewer people in early modern Europe had the possibility to repeat these experiments. And so part of what's been called the social technology in and around these discoveries, I think, was taking place for many people in their imagination rather than in their kitchen or drawing room.
It's just bad, though, isn't it? If you think about the replication crisis and all of the problems in science today about replicating results, I mean, couldn't it be part of the problem? People read a paper, they read about a result, a kind of wishful thinking kicks in. They think, yeah, I can imagine that being the case. And that almost substitutes for actually putting in the work of replicating it for real.
Yeah, and I think part of the verisimilitude of experimental descriptions is meant to reduce that implicit work of your own imagination and convince you that these things did take place. But there's a sleight of hand at work there, and I think that could be seen as...
But isn't that where training comes in, right? So it's not the case. I mean, there is surely the danger is not other scientists just reading that and going, yeah, that works for me. It's us reading it and saying, I believe that, right? But someone trained will spot the flaws in the experiment and will say, look, hang on a minute, this needs to be replicated and so on. So I don't think you can, I won't say you was going to say this, Jonathan, but I think you can't blame the imagination for the replication crisis.
But, you know, these issues of trust and authority are sort of well known around these kinds of issues.
Yeah, I mean, I started off, you know, about 10 minutes ago, thinking of thought experiments as just a kind of pretend experiment, like a kind of play experiment, not the real thing. It seems like it's possibly a point of agreement between all of you that's not right, you know, that thought experiments are literally experiments. They can be replicated in the same way. They provide evidence in basically the same way.
I mean, thought experiments aren't to be confused with kind of imagined experiments or imagining what an experiment might be like. They are meant to have some kind of force on their own. But people like Mark and Duhem, who were... Well, Duhem was a bit sceptical of thought experiments, but for him, that's what a thought experiment was. It was something that was very closely tied to experimental practice. But for most people, it's something that, on its own, functions a bit like an experiment or functions in a way that we get something out of it that isn't then that we need to go and do further work.
So do you think if Galileo had gone up the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped the balls for real, would that have provided, you know, a better kind of evidence, a different kind of evidence, or would it just have been completely pointless?
It wouldn't have worked, right? Because you would have had factors like air resistance there. So that's what the nice benefit of a thought experiment. You'd have things that it would interfere with it. So that's what's really nice about a thought experiment, is you can just stipulate what's there and what's not. So Galileo stresses that the differences we would experience if the thought experiment was performed as an actual experiment would be due to external factors like air resistance.
Yeah. It's not until, I just did this with my students actually in the philosophy of physics course, it's not until, when was it? Was it Apollo 12 when they go to the moon and he drops the hammer and the feather?
Yeah.
And they hit the, you know, because all you don't have any air resistance and they hit the surface at the same time. Still, people think, it was faked. But, you know, Galileo didn't have that opportunity, but it's not until that moment that you can actually sort of, in some sense, you know, replicate what he was trying to...
So that's when it was tested for real, on the moon?
We had to go to the moon to test it for real. but no one paid attention to that, because everyone was like, that's entirely what we expected. It's kind of cute to do it on the moon. They've got to do something while they're up there, but I don't think it convinced the science. Not just golf.
Great. I mean, let's invite some questions from the audience on this. I mean, either on Galileo and the example, or on the broader issue of what thought experiments are in science. There's a question from the third row there, and then we'll go back a few rows.
Right. I mean, my question would be that is any knowledge possible without exercising the faculty of imagination. What I'm trying to get at is this. Thinking, imagination, speculation, they're all kind of experiments. And nice thing about these experiments is that they are very cheap. You can do them without exercise, without spending too much energy, too much of money. And by this exercise, thought experiments. These experiments, you limit the area that you want to investigate further. So the question again was, is any knowledge possible without the faculty of imagination? Thank you.
Thoughts from Alice?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I like the idea you raised about how imagination can expand what we can investigate. So another nice thing about thought experiments is that we can do thought experiments when a real experiment would be impossible to do, right? So, for example, Einstein imagines himself chasing after a beam of light to consider, well, what would I observe if that was to happen? We can't do that, but that's what's quite a nice, a case of what a thought experiment can allow us to do. So that was a nice thought.
I'm perhaps a bit more, a little sceptical in response to that question. Great advances in science happen through various means. It's not clear to me that all of those advances happen through specific use of imagination. That Alice has got some nice examples of thought experiments, but not every theoretical advance has proceeded on the basis of a thought experiment. So I think you'd have to look at specific cases, and I'd be reluctant to make a very broad generalization that all knowledge somehow comes from imagination. I mean, I think you can have knowledge that comes from simply going out and observing things.
One thing I was going to say in response, which is a real 19th century development, particularly in self-registering instruments, things like photography, there was a real hope there that you could almost get rid of the people altogether and directly record nature's and the universe's many manifestations using this kind of technology. And they argued that that was very much a direct recording of facts from nature that was accumulating new knowledge, but had nothing of the fanciful about it. I mean, we can argue that back and forth, but there was a real conviction there that they were turning these things directly into concrete knowledge.
We have that today with big data, right?
Yeah.
Big data scientists want to say, look, we just gather loads and loads and loads of data.
And
we
then you look for patterns in the data, and there you have your knowledge.
We don't have to have hypotheses in advance. Yeah, let's have a question from, is it the sixth row back there?
So my question is broadly on to what extent you can consider just a pure mathematical proof a thought experiment to some degree, because it's sort of in the same way that you're saying that thought experiments are bounded by some measure of reality. If I'm just sort of fiddling with equation on a piece of paper, is that not just a formalized thought experiment? And if thought experiments are just like formalized reasoning, how much can they be said to be imagination?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think I'd like to separate engaging with things that are hypothetical from engaging with a thought experiment. There are qualities that resemble experiment that I think are really important. We manipulate certain features, we see what's going to happen. There are lots of cases of thought experiments in mathematics, particularly ones that use pictures. So there's a relation there. I've forgotten the second part of your question.
If thought experiments are just bound by laws of mathematics or other strips of reality, how much is there imagination or just already
I mean, I think the regurgitation of what we already know, this is like rooted in what's called the puzzle of thought experiments. And this goes back to Kuhn, who asks, well, given that we get no new empirical observations when we're doing a thought experiment, we are just reasoning from old to new, how can these things be informative? Now, if you think that thought experiments are just arguments, which some people do think they are, then these things do just work as deductive inferences from stuff we already know. But I think that misses a really important feature of what thought experiments do, which is to, as the things we've been picking up on already, they allow us to imaginatively explore things. And actually, when we try to reconstruct what went on in the thought experiment into just kind of pure logical deduction, we miss some of what's epistemically valuable about them. So maybe some thought experiments could be handled in that way, but I think it'd be wrong to say that they all can.
Let's have another question from the second row.
I'm puzzled that the word logic hasn't been mentioned perhaps at all, if not very often anyway so far. What counts in Galileo's very clever thought experiment is the kind of logic of why Aristotle's account doesn't quite work. This becomes, as you say, a self-contradiction. That's what counts, rather than a depiction in an imaginative way. I mean, it took some imagination to come up with that way of presenting the argument, but it's a kind of a logical analysis, isn't it, of what's at fault with Aristotle's theory. So that's what counts, and that's what sort of distinguishes these cases from ordinary experiments. I mean, if it's a logical matter, it's like a proof, like a mathematical thing. I don't look for replication there. If I were clever enough to write a mathematical proof and show people, as long as there's no mistakes in it, I don't really care whether you replicate that or not. That's not the point.
Yeah.
If I've shown it's done and it's not something horribly complicated that hardly anybody can figure out to check, once you've seen it, you've got it, and I don't really care how many people get it. I've just done it. I've proved it. That's kind of different from a science experiment where we need people to replicate it quite a few times to see that it is actually sound in some sense, that I haven't overlooked something or it wasn't some peculiar artifact of my laboratory that created the successful result and so on.
Yes.
Just one quick thing, that it's an odd thing to say that imagination isn't serious. You'd made an odd contrast with the seriousness of verification and so on, as if imagination
were
not serious.
Well, of course,
that's
the sceptical view that these guys want to reject.
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, let's hear from Alice about this relation between thought experiments and proof.
Yeah, I mean, the Galileo example works like a reductio, right? It shows that Aristotle's theory leads us to an absurd consequence. It's a contradiction. But actually, I think the force of the thought experiment, and when we perform it in our imagination, what can actually happen is that we don't consider possible logical ways out of the conclusion. So some have actually debated as to whether, and I don't know the details, but whether Aristotle's theory actually is a contradiction. But what Galileo does is he gives us this scenario. We go through it using all this tacit knowledge that we already have, and that seems to be the conclusion. But actually, there might be logically available ways out. So therefore, again, I don't think it can be fully captured if we do just think of it in those terms.
I mean, one thing I find really interesting in relation to this is the internal logic to a thought experiment, which has to exist, which is, I guess, akin to world-building in fantasy or sci-fi, that you can make up another planet, but you have to have internal logic to the rules which you've set up. Otherwise, people will easily catch you out and spot the flaws. And I think that's true of a good thought experiment as well, that it has to be bound by certain kinds of conditions, which you can then see play out and follow along as we do with Galileo's.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks. Well, more opportunities for questions later. But for now, let's talk about our second key topic, which is about the relation between the scientific imagination and the artistic imagination. I mean, Stephen, I mean, what do you think about this? Do you think that when we talk about imagination in science and imagination in art, we're talking about fundamentally the same thing?
Yeah, that's a crucial question. And there is a view, again, it's a kind of sceptical view, that says, no, it's not the same thing, that what you have in scientific theorising is something else. It's supposition, it's hypothesising, it's not the same as imagination in art. So, here's an example I prepared earlier. This is from Great Expectations, and for those of you who know your Dickens, this is the bit where Pip comes back from visiting Miss Havisham, and basically he's suddenly aware of his place in society, that he is common. And he thinks, and Dickens writes, "That was a memorable day to me, for it made great changes in me and in my fortunes. But it is the same with any life. Imagine one selected day struck out of it, and think how different its course would have been. Pause, you who read this, and think for a moment of the long chain of iron or gold, of thorns or flowers that would never have bound you but for the formation of the first link on one memorable day. Here Dickens is inviting the reader to imagine a day taken out of your life that would change your life forever. And so the question I was interested in is, well, do we find any similar invitations to imagine in scientific work? Right? Not suppositions, but an actual invitation to imagine. Well, no surprises that I'm going to argue or going to suggest, yes, we can. Here's an example. It's from Einstein. It's from one of his papers of his miraculous year of 1905, when he published a whole bunch of papers, any one of which should have won him the Nobel Prize. This is the paper on special relativity. I'm not going to sling a whole bunch of space-time physics at you. but he says the following. Let there be given a stationary rigid rod. Let its length be L, as measured by a measuring rod, which is also stationary. We now imagine the axis of the rod lying along the x-axis of the stationary system of coordinates. And then he goes on to say, we impart a motion to the rod, uniform motion with velocity V. We now inquire, he says, as to the length of the moving rod, and imagine its length to be ascertained by certain operations. He goes on. We imagine further that at the two ends, A and B of the rod, clocks are placed, which synchronize with the clocks of the stationary system. And he goes on. We imagine further that with each clock there is a moving observer, and that these observers apply to both clocks the criterion established for the synchronization of two clocks. Now there, Einstein seems to be making exactly the same appeal as Dickens. He's appealing to the imagination. Right? He's doing it in a way that relates to what Alice has just said. He's appealing to what we already know about clocks and rods. Right? And he's using that, he's inviting us to imagine, and he's using that to basically theorize about the implications of his principles of relativity for our measurements of length and of time. Okay, so I think this is quite, you know, a remarkable passage, and Einstein does this again. Right, so referring to one of the questions, what about theorizing that is heavy on mathematics, that involves, you know, considerable mathematics? Do you have appeals to the imagination there? Well, if you fast forward 12 years to Einstein's extension of his special theory of relativity to his general theory of relativity, okay, there you don't have these explicit appeals to the imagination, right? You have a lot of maths, tensors, non-Euclidean geometry, right? So it's that's the international physicist sign for curved space-time, sort of waving hands. You have this curved space-time. But interestingly, Einstein gives an address in 1921 to the Prussian Academy of Sciences, right? So this is to his fellow scientists. And he's basically talking to them about his theory and about the use of this strange geometry. And again, he constantly, throughout this piece, he appeals to sort of visualizable examples, and he appeals to the imagination. And he says something. He says, in this way, by using as stepping stones the practice in thinking and visualization, which Euclidean geometry, the geometry that we all know, the geometry of Pythagoras' theorem and so on, which Euclidean geometry gives us, we have acquired a mental picture of spherical geometry, this non-Euclidean geometry. And he says, we may, without difficulty, impart more depth and vigor to these ideas by carrying out special imaginary constructions. So here, Einstein, I mean, there's two things I wanted to say. One is, it seems to me, Einstein, as I said before, is doing the same thing as Dickens was doing. He was inviting the reader to use their imagination. And the second thing, he was doing it not to create a new theory, right, but to theorize, but to basically, you know, to develop, to explicate, to help us understand his theory. Okay. So this is, you know, where the role of the imagination, I think, is more extensive than I think many people have perhaps appreciated. And certainly the view that, yeah, science, once you get past, you know, the creative stage, once you've got the theory, the imagination, there's no more use for the imagination. I just don't think that's true. I don't think it's true in every case that, you know, the imagination necessarily is involved. But in these cases, it's explicit. Einstein invites you to imagine, just as Dickens did.
So in the example of Einstein, I sort of want to ask, who's we, right? We imagine. As a non-expert, I'm finding it very difficult to go through the imaginative exercise he's describing. Is he writing only for incredibly gifted physicists? Or is it just me?
Sorry, Jonathan, it's just you. No, I mean, look, first of all, I mean, take the 1905 paper, right? That's now being translated in English. It's easily available. It is actually quite accessible. He writes, Einstein,
so
he's writing for a scientist. Okay, he himself is writing for the scientific community. But I actually think that paper is certainly accessible, I would imagine, to anyone in this room, because he's talking about, again, he's relating it to things that we can easily, or maybe not these days with iPhones and whatever, but in the days when there were clocks, right, we could relate what he's saying straightforwardly, you know, to our own experience. And like, when you get to the general theory of relativity, there he's speaking to the Prussian Academy of Sciences. Now, again, he's not necessarily, I think, addressing particularly gifted physicists. No slur on the Prussian Academy. But I think it was quite a general audience. And certainly that second paper, which is called Geometry and Experience, I give, you know, I use it with my students, for example. Again, it's a very accessible paper. He's really trying to take the general reader through these steps. And Einstein himself set great store, I think, by the imagination. There's this famous quote where he says, you know, imagination is better than knowledge, right? But he goes on to say, imagination is a real factor in scientific research, right? And what he meant by that is, it's not just a matter of using it to create, you know, fancy scenarios. It's actually using it to theorize.
So what is Einstein trying to achieve in this example with the clocks, right? I mean, is it that he already knows what he's trying to get across? He's already worked it out in some other way, and he's just trying to explain the theory in a way that people less clever than him might be able to follow. You know, in other words, is the use of the imagination here just a kind of pedagogical teaching use, or is there more to it than that?
That's a really good point. I think in the 1905 paper, there's more to it than that. Why? In 1905, Einstein, I've got to be careful here because there might be some smart historian of physics in the room who's going to correct me, but I think Einstein was still in the grip of Marx's influence, of this kind of positive influence that science was about, fundamentally, about what was observable. Mm. And in 1905, you can say, to a certain degree, I think, special relativity wasn't really about space-time. That comes later. It was about clocks and rods. Einstein doesn't begin the paper. Let's think about space and time. It's all about what can we measure. Here's how we measure. Here's how we measure length with rigid rod. Here's how we measure temporal duration with clocks. So because of that, because for him, special relativity was about clocks and rods, it's not mere pedagogy. This is him theorizing. Right? Now, of course, when you say had he worked it out, he'd obviously, you know, we're not seeing a sort of live transcript of his thought in that paper. That's a prepared paper. Yeah. But he certainly hadn't, in 1905, thought, yes, this is about space-time, but I've got to make it accessible to those numpties in the Prussian Academy. I'll talk about clocks and rods. No, he doesn't do that. Mm. This is how he is thinking about special relativity. Mm. 1906... Minkowski, the mathematician, comes in and says, hey, I can, you know, capture all of that in terms of this new entity, space-time. And Minkowski says, henceforth, space and time have receded into the shadows. Einstein wasn't keen on that initially. But as he, I think, developed as a physicist and kind of shed his sort of positivistic leanings. He came to appreciate the value of thinking of it, of his theory in terms of this new entity of space-time. That led him into the general theory. There, the role of imagination in the theorising is, I think you can argue, is diminished. And in the Geometry and Experience paper, I think there's probably a good point, a good argument to say, yeah, that is more pedagogical. He is trying to take his colleagues at the Prussian Academy through steps to get them to appreciate the peculiar nature of this new space-time.
So the role of the imagination actually changes over time for Einstein during his life. You know, and at the initial stages of the development of special relativity, you think it was really crucial that the theory was about everyday objects, everyday measuring devices, because they could be easily imagined.
And so, exactly. I think that's a really good point. I think it changes through that particular trajectory in the history of physics. It raises an interesting question we've kind of touched on. You know, when it comes to really sort of high-level theoretical physics of the kind that we do, that we engage in today, is there then a role for the imagination? Well, it's very difficult to visualize. Some would say impossible to visualize the 17-dimensional space of string theory, or the infinite-dimensional space of Hilbert space in quantum mechanics, right? I think an optimistic answer would be, difficult for us, but is it so difficult for the mathematicians and physicists doing that? Would they deny that they're using the imagination? Perhaps you have to train your imagination, perhaps you have to stretch your imagination, and that's what part of being educated in the field does, so that you can actually imagine an electron spin half, what would it look like in this kind of, multi-dimensional space? I can't imagine that, but I imagine, that mathematicians and physicists could.
Mm. I mean, let's bring in Melanie and Alice on this.
I mean, another thing I was thinking, though, is in these areas where it is so difficult, like string theory, actually the types of activities that I've been talking about and you've been talking about might be a way to help our understanding of those areas. So perhaps uses of examples that do draw in our imagination and can allow us to kind of see how things might work might become common. Thought experiments and the type of imaginative activity you were describing help us understand things. So perhaps maybe not in that theorizing aspect, but in trying to get a scientific community or a public community to get what they're on about.
Yeah. And I know I'm certainly more comfortable in the 19th rather than the 20th century, but as far as the new physics goes, I could certainly follow things as far as the stories, the trains and the twins and the gunshots and all of the exciting analogies and the narratives which are put around these mathematical equations, really, but things which can be conjured to the imagination, for me at least, much more readily. But I wanted to bring us back to Dickens, and so that was really interesting you started with him. I always feel like Einstein in the Swiss Patent Office could be like a figure in a Dickens novel, surrounded by all of these inventions, like an old curiosity shop. Because earlier today I was actually at the Dickens Museum just up the road. They've got a current exhibition on called Charles Dickens, Man of Science, and it opens with some really interesting observations, actually, on how Dickens' reputation for not being interested in science is something we've believed erroneously for 150 years. And actually, one thing that you can really see in his life and in his writings is a fascination with processes of detailed observation and how that is something which can be connected with imaginative conjecture and something which also can connect to real-world problems. So there's a fascinating thread, I think, that connects Dickens himself to science, as well as Dickens' use of the imagination to later uses of the imagination by scientific figures. And perhaps all of this helps belie this separation into what we might call science and art.
I mean, Alice, what do you think about Dickens versus Einstein? I mean, are they I'm not saying who's the best
match,
but are they really doing the same thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one thing I was thinking about when you were describing the two examples is what type of imagination is involved in these cases. So in the Pip case, it seems to be perhaps the type of imagination where we're meant to put ourselves into someone else's shoes, to kind of imagine feelings, think about what that might be like, taking on a perspective. I'm not sure how that might carry over to the science cases. I mean, I think in some thought experiments, maybe that is the type of thing we're being asked to do, but perhaps not in that case. So we might, I mean, I think the imagination is rich and there's loads of different types of imaginative activity we can do, whether it's this kind of perspective taking or kind of quasi-sensory imagination or one that's more propositional in
nature. I think that's crucial. I mean, that's a really good point. I think for the Einstein example, it does seem to be, you know, like you said, quasi-sensory, right? So you're imagining, you know, a clock and you're imagining this rock. And not, not all imagination is like that. Einstein, I think, constantly comes back to that quasi-sensory aspect. So maybe for him, and maybe it differs from scientist to scientist, but for him, that was important. And it's linked to, I think, relationship between imagination and visualizability. For him, I think for Einstein, that was important. And we know, we can find other examples from physics, I mean, what I know, where visualizability is crucially important. But I wouldn't say that's going to be the case for every use of imagination in science.
But I think imagination can really help us with changes of scale or with extra dimensions. And I think there's really interesting ways in which fiction, novels, are also spaces of, like you say, experiment, thought experiment, and ways in which you can have a different kind of empathy. That's one thing I think is really interesting about imagination and empathy, and how it can put you into someone else's point of view, or even a non-human point of view. And I think if we broaden out our spectrum of the kinds of science we're looking at, you can say, yes, how do you, perhaps field scientists use their imagination? You might say, well, they don't use their imagination at all, they're just going out there. But actually, if you talk to ethologists or people that I think really try to, you know more about this than I do, Jonathan, but see things from the point of view of other things they're studying or other creatures. There's a real imaginative role there.
And sometimes I think in literature, look, our imagination is stretched just as it is in science, right? So I read a lot of science fiction, right? And there's a book I was going back to the other week, a memorable book, it's called Appleseed by John Clute. And it's a difficult book to read. And the reason it's difficult but also memorable is he's trying to describe aliens, real aliens, not, you know, pointy ears and, you know, a few furrows on the forehead or a few, you know, ridges on the nose. Really alien beings, right, who have completely... And the book is actually quite hard to read because it's hard to imagine. He uses lots of the quite convoluted descriptions to try and convey the sense of alienness. And I actually found my imagination sort of stretched and ding, it snapped. You know, I couldn't really, you know, in the end, you know, just let it wash over me. I'll just read through it. I think, and there's other examples from literature where, you know, we just don't have the capacity, I think, perhaps to imagine what the author is trying to convey.
In literature, that would often be considered a bad thing, right? If the book is unintelligible to the reader. I mean, it makes me wonder whether physics has a problem. You know, in that, as you were saying earlier, physics, theoretical physics, has now become so technical, so arcane, so mathematical, that even though the specialists can imagine and visualize what they're talking about, it seems like the public can't. And to some extent, a lot of their fellow physicists can't, and scientists in other disciplines can't. It means we lose that sense of communication that was possible for Einstein when he was talking about clocks and rods. Yeah.
But then maybe, I mean, the great, you know, science popularizers, you know, think of Brian Greene and string theory, that's where they come in, right? So I don't think we can expect, you know, given the current state of physics, I don't think we can expect physicists, okay, guys, dumb it down for us, right? Come on. You know, because we've advanced so much further now that even than, you know, general theory of relativity, you look at theories of quantum gravity, you really need those kinds of mathematical tools and those kinds of mathematical spaces that really stretch our imagination. But then you have people like, you know, Carlo Rovelli, right, who's a physicist, he writes... he's just written a lovely little book on time. He's able to convey his ideas. He's able to get us to use our imagination, to, you know, imagine what it's like to be at the level of, you know, of a causal set and how space and time emerge from that. I think he's quite good at that, and that's where I think that aspect of science, you know, we tend to dismiss it as science popularization, but maybe now that's where the imagination is really playing an important role. I mean, in effect, that's what Einstein, I think, was doing with his 1921 paper, Geometry Experience. It was a kind of science popularization. Mm-hmm. Now we don't expect the Nobel Prize winners. It would be nice, but we don't expect them to do that. But we have people like Carlo Rovelli, Brian Greene, who are able to do that for us. Not that Carlo Rovelli shouldn't get the Nobel Prize. I mean, he should as well. But, you know.
I mean, let's take some questions from the audience on this, either on the issues raised earlier about thought experiments and Galileo, all the topics we've just been talking about, Dickens versus Einstein, the imagination in science and in literature. It's a question from the middle of the second row there, and then we'll go further back.
Hi, my name is Ashwin. Let me just chuck a grenade in here for a second. For Einstein's a friendly, affable genius, the image of it, and the guy who doesn't wear shoes to work. But for every Einstein, there is a von Neumann. And von Neumann wasn't quite the image of the imaginative artist like Einstein was. Now, my question is, say in 100 years, you look at science, and if you could remove imagination from science today, and if you could remove systematic theory articulation from science today, which picture of science do you think would look better in 100 years?
First of all, let me just say, first of all, I'm a big fan. I'm not quite sure why you contrasted Einstein with von Neumann. I'm a big fan of von Neumann. I don't see that as, you know, I think it's a slightly odd kind of contrast to make. You know, von Neumann was a great mathematician, but in his discussion of the measurement problem in quantum mechanics, right, this is stretching it a bit, but he invites us to imagine quantum mechanics as applying to every physical aspect of the universe. If the wave function is going to collapse, there has to be something that's non-physical involved, and for von Neumann, it was consciousness. Now, that's not the kind of von Neumann I think you were appealing to, the sort of mathematician who doesn't use imagination. As I said before, I think it varies from scientist to scientist. If your question is, if we somehow removed the faculty of imagination from every scientist, right, what would science look like? Would it be, you know, would there be any science? I think, yes, there would be science. It's not clear. Would it be the same science? Is imagination essential for doing science? Or, you know, can we do without it? Could we program machines? You know, the rise of the machines. You know, they can just do all the science for us. Would that be the same science? I'm not even sure I know how to answer those questions, because, I mean, that's where my imagination starts to fail me. You're asking me to envisage a different world in which scientists are doing things quite differently. I am skeptical of the suggestion that somehow von Neumann was a better scientist than Einstein, or was operated in a different way without any use of the imagination. I'm very skeptical of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, I think, five rows from the back there.
So I feel like you've concentrated right now on thought experiments in the world of physics, and it kind of sounds like we're focusing on what you can extrapolate from knowledge that already exists. And I was wondering if you could touch upon imagination in completely new discoveries. And like a random example I'd use is the discovery of atoms or the discovery of DNA. Like, does imagination play a part in knowing what questions to ask and then knowing how to interpret completely new discoveries?
Yeah, it's a nice question. I think that's perhaps what we were touching on a little bit when we were talking about creativity. And I guess that's what I took where we might normally see where the imagination plays a role. So, that would be my answer. I don't know.
Here's a related example that a colleague suggested to me. Jonathan, I think, knows more about this than I do. It was Darwin, who at one point imagines nature to be a farmer, selectively breeding. And so my colleague said, look, here's Darwin, as we're exercising or appealing to the imagination at a crucial point in his argument about natural selection. Right? So again, it's Darwin, you know, invoking the imagination as part of his theorising. This is outside of physics. I wouldn't want you to think that somehow only physicists use their imagination. All other scientists are very dull fellows. No, I mean, yeah, I think this is true of a range of scientists. I like your point about the role of the imagination in asking the right questions. I think that's a really interesting issue, because it's not just, you know, what if or what about this scenario or, you know, this kind of thought experiment or using the imagination in theorizing. It's, you know, what kinds of questions should I be asking? And I wish I could give you a better answer. I actually think that's a really interesting question to look at, perhaps some of the, you know, the scientists in their very early stages of thinking about their work and imagining the kinds of questions that really should be asked.
I think we're getting also into these ideas of science as an act of communication at all levels, so not just something which happens downstream as part of popularization, but even in the very act of creating, of communicating to oneself what one thought. On certain subjects, what are possible lines of inquiry, whatever the science, that there's a really important role there for thinking things through.
The discovery of DNA is a nice example of the importance of real physical models.
Yeah.
Famously, Watson and Crick didn't just come up with the structure in their head, but they made a physical model.
Yeah.
Are we still in the realm of the imagination there? I mean, can there be hybrids of
X-rays from Rosie Franklin's X-rays to that model? Mm. So, I mean, is it just a matter of them measuring, you know, the angles and figuring it out? One could surely. I mean, I don't know because you haven't looked at the notebooks, or, you know, there's no recording of Crick saying yes, and I imagined the model to look like this, and then we built it. But, you know, I would imagine that something like that went on, that as they were looking at the X-ray photographs, they could envisage how this would fit together. And then, as we all know, there was some issue about getting the angles right and making sure that steel plates were correct.
I mean, I think these things are really complexly intertwined, actually,
that
there is this artificial separation that's been made across the centuries of the reason and the imagination, and that actually, even if we were to write our own account, as many of the people who are involved with the double helix discovery did, of trying to repeat our thought processes, that's a hard word to say, that actually it would be hard to disentangle what we could categorise as pure reasoning or juxtaposition and what were these more imaginative leaps. I think it's really difficult to disentangle.
Yeah, and I think how models are often used, whether they're mathematical models or physical models, are kind of props to help us imagine and help guide our imaginings.
And I think the very use of that term now slips between real, virtual, and imagined models.
There's an imaginative element in any modelling in science. Let's take one more question here.
Thank you very much. Somebody mentioned John von Neumann, so this question I wouldn't have asked unless I had mentioned him. He was obviously one of the most figures 20th century gave us, the theory of Gaines behavior. But he was born Hungarian Jew, died a Roman Catholic, actually. And I wanted to just wonder, I think it might be relevant, is religion in any sense relevant to the use of imagination in science? Yeah. Has religion got a role?
Here's something I've learned recently. And I've learned it from a fellow historian of science, Rob Iliff. He's about to give his inaugural professorial lecture in Oxford, November 8th, if anyone's in Oxford at that time, free publicity for Rob. And he's done some really interesting work. He's, in his talk, points out that attitudes, as Melanie knows as well, of course, attitudes to the imagination have changed dramatically. And Rob, as I understand it, identifies that shift as taking place in the 18th century. Prior to that, imagination was regarded as fanciful. Imagination was regarded as leading you astray. Imagination would lead you to have lecherous thoughts, said Newton. And Newton famously said, hypotheses non fingo, I feign no hypotheses, where feign is an archaic term for imagine. And Rob associates that attitude with a particular kind of sort of puritanical Protestantism that is, I wish I could remember his slide, but there's a those of you who know your Bible may know there's a passage in the Bible that basically, you know, tells you to, you know, don't let your imagination run away with you. It's associated with the anti-idolatry of certain forms of Protestantism.
It's catchy.
Not just Catholic, but you know, forms of religious belief that allow you to exercise the imagination with regard to God, and you shouldn't do that. And that changed. And as I understand it, part of the reason it changed was a shift in sort of, you know, the religious context of the time. And it changed in the 18th century, and imagination came to be associated with creativity. And I think, as Melanie knows, I think, you know, more than I do, I think that then fed into the 19th century. And Einstein, of course, is a product, in many senses, of the 19th century. I mean, he emerges as a physicist in the early 20th century. But, you know, his background and training comes in the late 19th century. So that's, I think, one way in which religion certainly has an impact on our attitudes to the imagination in science.
Yeah. More chances to ask questions later, but this brings us very nicely onto our third key topic, which is the history of the scientific imagination. I mean, Melanie, you've already told us the crucial connections between the sort of liberation of the scientific imagination and the kind of scientific revolution of the 17th century or so. I mean, tell us more about this story, how the scientific imagination has changed over time.
Well, I think one really interesting way to look at this is the words which have been used to talk about the imagination. So is it the mind's eye? Is it the fancy? What kind of models do people use? The science of the imagination, if you'd like to think of it like that. Is this a phrenological faculty that we could identify as a bump on our head? Is this a cognitive process that everyone has to go through? So how have, in different times and places and cultures, I'm very conscious we're just talking about Western European science here today, where there's been this particular narrative developed around an increasing separation between an artistic and a scientific imagination, and I think a really interesting way of tracing that is to see how people have conceived of and conceptualised the imagination itself. And following on from what Stephen just very nicely queued up for me there, we see this really interesting shift from early modern ideas of imagination, and I think really wonderfully characterised by Voltaire in his entry on the imagination in the Encyclopédie for Diderot and D'Alembert. Apologies for my French. And he talks about two kinds of imagination. So we're in the late 18th century at this point. There's an active imagination, which is a generative imagination. It's where everybody, artist, philosopher, chemist, writer, where you get your ideas from, where you can really go beyond your everyday experience and branch out into these new realms of thought. And that's seen as absolutely crucial for any kind of new knowledge or art generating activity. But he contrasts this with a passive or a slightly more malevolent imagination, which I think is the ancestor of Newton's lecherous imagination, which is something which is pathological. It's a dangerous.
The thoughts running wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And that this is something that one has to be constantly vigilant about, and that everybody is prey to this potential disease, that you might succumb to these temptations of whatever imaginings have you in their grip. And there's really interesting ways in which that reflects ideas about conscious and unconscious imaginations. So I think we mentioned earlier that the imagination was something that we can control, but for many people it absolutely wasn't something you could control. It was something which took you over through dreams, most commonly, but also through addictions. And so there's this sort of dark underbelly to the imagination. And I think what really happens across the Romantic period and into the 19th century is the imagination sort of joins itself back together as something which is dangerous and tempting and drags you away from what's really around. And science sort of migrates to the other side of this equation and is seen as something which is factual, which has to be rooted in observable sense data around the world, partly because men of science themselves are trying to build their authority and they want these kinds of things which they can really communicate and provide evidence for people to use in society.
I mean, let's talk about dreams and science. Mm. Right? There's the famous story of Kekulé trying to work out the structure of benzene, having this dream about a snake chasing its own tail and seeing that the molecule could be a ring. Is that characteristic of the period, or is this just something that has always happened in science, do you think?
Well, I think people always dream.
But linking it to science.
I mean, I think there's this particularly fertile period when people are really trying to put together these new kinds of ideas, and on some subconscious level, this is also happening while they're sleeping. I mentioned earlier the fact that often this is a reassemblage of things one already knows, rings and snakes and chemistry, into something which is sort of maybe a flash of insight.
I mean, Descartes has this idea, right, that everything that is present in dreams must have been experienced in some form. You know, so you dream a unicorn, it's because you've experienced a horse and a horn, and in the dream you put them together. And this seems to feed into this idea that dreams can be places where genuine insight into the world. Mm.
But dreams can also be nightmares, and this is a really interesting backdrop, particularly to early 19th century debates about education and science, because they're saying you shouldn't give children fairy stories with monsters and dangerous creatures and all these things that are going to feed their imaginations, because then they'll have these sort of night terrors and you'll really encourage them down this almost devilish path. And away from what they should be learning to be, which are sort of responsible, upstanding citizens and people who know about the contemporary world. A very close connection to the evangelical revival there, coming back to ideas of religion. But a really sort of tense moment of educational debate, which Dickens famously talks about in his Hard Times, is the facts or fancy debate. And fancy there standing in for the monstrous, the fantastic, the fairy tale. Einstein, a big fairy tale fan, as we know. So these debates, I think, play out in slight different terms.
What was the debate there? Fact or fancy?
So on the one hand, there were people writing lots and lots of these new science books for children, which really attempted to bring new subjects like chemistry or geology and old subjects like physics or geography to childish audiences. And they often were coming from dissenting families or from people who were really trying to say that knowledge is the basis for education. And by knowledge, they mean nature often. And then other people who say, actually, the old nursery rhymes and fairy tales are what children are naturally drawn to, and it's what people should be educated through, opportunities to exercise their imagination rather than opportunities to be crammed, is often the verb used, crammed with knowledge and facts. Mm. They're sort of the caricature position.
A debate that continues today.
Absolutely.
Can I ask something, though, about that? So does that link to the rise of positivism in the 19th century with Comte, with the idea, I mean, you alluded it earlier, Jonathan, in regard to Alice, the distinction between discovery and justification, and the positive idea that all the scientific action happens with justification, that it doesn't matter how, whether you have a dream about a hypothesis or you got it through some drug-addled vision, it was the justification of it, the relationship to experiment, that's important. That's where the facts are. Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying, does that relate to the rise of positivism through Comte in the 19th century, or is that separate? I mean, there is more emphasis on how science should be done, and it should be done in this rather rigid way.
Yeah, I think there's really interesting relationships between positivism also with the realist novel. I think there's really interesting connections there. And also, again, about who is allowed to imagine.
Right.
and where that fits in. If you are a practicing man of science, are you allowed to speculate? This is a huge issue in evolutionary science across the period. In geology, I think particularly paleontology, I find it particularly interesting, because something like comparative anatomy, say, okay, you get a bone, and then you imagine the whole of the extinct creature. And that is a piece of logical imagining and reasoning for people who've been trained in this really new science in the early part of the 19th century. And there's a live debate as to who should get to do that imagining and how the results of that should be then promulgated.
Who can be trusted, right? You know, who's just drawing a made-up fanciful creature?
And there's a real debate about whether you should even put illustrations in these kinds of books for wider audiences, because they're not doing that hard work of the trained imagination. They're just seeing, there it is, full, you know, reconstructed skeleton.
And they got it wrong, didn't they? Because some of the models of dinosaurs at that time, it's like, no, they didn't.
Well, the famous example of the Crystal Palace monsters, famously still there and listed buildings now, I think. And there's a wonderful example of this from Margaret Oliphant, who writes in the 1850s about going to see them, and she recommends to young visitors that they close their eyes very hard as they approach these models, because she says you don't get the pleasure of imagining for yourself what these creatures look like.
Right.
She says that because someone has reconstructed a 3D model of an iguanodon in front of you, all of the pleasure for her and the learning of the geology and the paleontology which has gone into it happens for you in the process of imagining it. And by leapfrogging over that and just saying, here it is, it looks almost ready to bite your head off, then that has effaced all of the good work, the good training which you're imagining.
So building the model was actually a bad thing, because it deprives you of that imaginative experience.
Yeah, and that was something you've seen as crucial to learning this new subject, because at the core of it was this process of reconstruction.
That you had to be trained to learn.
And the models were completely wrong, right?
Not completely. They were based on the most up-to-date authoritative knowledge of the day.
Or at least by the lights of contemporary paleontology, we think they're completely wrong.
Well, by 1854, they were cutting it.
The iguanodon is the one with the pointy thumb, right? Yeah. And they thought it was on its head or something like that. The point. And I mean, there was obviously some, you know, the danger there was that you accept that model, you never have that imaginative insight that maybe this bit is actually on the thumb, not the head.
I mean, and this is why I think paleontology is a really great new science to bring into the debate, because one thing that imagination can do, as we talked about with physics and with space-time and high dimensions, but also with deep time as space-time, it can take you places where you can't actually go.
Yeah.
And I think there's in evolutionary time, coming back to Darwin, there's a really important role, I think, for the imagination there. But coming back to education, how you are trained to do that in a responsible way and challenge, as Jonathan just said, previous imaginative conjectures, or not just conjectures, actual sort of reconstructions.
The part of the skill there is the skill to not accept everything that previous generations have put in front of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it brings us to this big question, really, of can the scientific imagination be trained? When we think about people like Einstein, Galileo, obviously they had a lot of mathematical training, they learned a lot of physics, but there's the sense of that imaginative element of what they were doing, that sort of insight. Is that something that can be trained, or is that some kind of innate genius that no one knows how to teach?
Well, I think for all of these things, there's a sense that childhood and science have this interesting relationship. And in many ways, children are seen as somehow innate or natural. Curious people, they're naturally imaginative, you know, it's tends to be younger people who have imaginary friends who see the monsters and the pink elephants and things. I think we can be a bit more critical about that than just accepting it and saying that actually people are taught through educational processes how to build ideas on top of other ideas, how to trust their senses. We were talking a lot about deception. So I definitely think there's a role for training.
I'm always sceptical about claims to people to be geniuses,
yeah.
As if it's...
Even if it's Einstein.
Even if it's Einstein, because,
especially.
I mean, he certainly was
especially
a great, you know, physicist, but you think, oh, yeah, there was something, some faculty in him that no one else could touch. No one. Same for von Neumann, right? He was possibly the greatest mathematician. You know, some people think he's the greatest mathematician ever. So was there some innate faculty? I don't think that's quite the right way of looking at it. I think if you look at their backgrounds and you start to realise it's this kind of juxtaposition of different factors. I mean, Einstein, everyone says, oh, yeah, Einstein, he was a patent clerk and he wrote these brilliant papers. As if he hadn't studied physics before that. He had studied physics in great depth. He had, you know, immense training in physics. He'd read all the literature of the time. But also, at the age of 16, he had, you know, conducted this famous thought experiment. Can you run as fast as a light beam? Mm. And it's that juxtaposition of, you know, we all have, you know, well, could I do this? Could I leap, you know, a tall building with a single bound, right? Einstein was able to engage in that kind of imaginative what-if scenario, but to bring to it his knowledge and sort of insight into the physics, and to say, actually, if I did run as fast as a light beam, and the light beam then would look frozen, but that would be in violation of Maxwell's electrodynamics, because I know Maxwell's electrodynamics. And then he began to work out the consequences. It's that combination that makes him a great physicist.
But I think just the very concept of genius has a history and comes in at the same time that
right.
we're talking about, the sort of late 18th century, the genius gets coded as male, the moment of discovery gets, you know, retrospectively written as a
yeah.
flash of insight.
Yeah.
The genius, I think,
yeah.
is susceptible to both kinds of imagination that were being talked about at that time.
Yeah.
The genius can be the creative wonder or can be the bad genius,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
that can fall prey yeah. to the pathological imagination.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting that you've got that kind of historical contemporaneity.
Yeah.
Is that a word? They happen at the same time.
I mean, let's bring in Alice on this.
I was just
saying... scientific imagination be trained?
I think it's something that can get better with more experience. So I remember Mike Stewart, who's formerly of LSE, he came and gave a talk to us on... So he'd done some work within laboratories, and he was just asking scientists about... Do you use your imagination? In what context do you use it? Do you think the imagination has an important function in what you're doing? And he found that the more junior people in the labs were like, no, I never use my imagination. I follow these rules and this is what I'm doing. Whereas those who were more senior and had more experience with the types of things they were doing were very happy to say that they use their imagination. So I think there you can see how experience maybe makes you more confident to make these leaps, but I think also you make... leaps that are going to be better. They are constrained in a certain type of way.
Yeah.
And you're responding to something that you know very well. So creativity isn't just random ideas all the time, right? It's ideas that are going to respond well and help you out. Yeah.
There's an aspect of pattern recognition, you know, seeing where the good problems are, where the solutions might be.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, let's take some final questions from the audience then on any of the topics we've discussed, including this issue of whether the scientific imagination can be trained. Let's start at the very front row and then go back.
There's two things here. I came in late, so I don't know if you mentioned them. Thought experiments and intuitive thinking. Thought experiment constituted largely the basic ideas of Einstein in the first place. Later, I mean, it was as valid as a laboratory experiment. Later, it was confirmed by the Sirius X reflection of light and all that, relativity. But initially, thought experiments was most part of Einstein's theory was based on it initially. As for intuitive thinking, I mean, forgive me if you mentioned it. I mean, I came in late, as I said. Intuitive thinking, Democritus, the ancient Greek thinker, he described the atom with such a precision, you will not believe it, at a time when the most advanced technical thing available was the wheel. In ancient Greece, the wheel was the most advanced technical apparatus available. And yet, he just by sitting on the beach and let his imagination go, he described the atom with amazing accuracy, even by today's standards.
I'm not convinced by that. Didn't he and Leucippus think of atoms as having little hooks and eyes on them, like Velcro? They thought of atoms as how they bonded via these hooks and eyes.
It's pretty impressive if you imagine Velcro.
Yeah.
No, I think Democritus should be acknowledged as the discoverer of Velcro.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit much to say that through the power of imagination, Democritus was able to conceive of the atom as we currently know it. It was, I think, it's an interesting question whether different sciences involve the imagination, but whether science at different periods of history can be said to involve the imagination. Or sciences you mentioned, Melanie, we're just talking about Western science here. What about sciences in different parts of the world? Is the imagination involved in different ways in different sciences at different points in history? I think those are interesting issues that we haven't really touched on. I don't know if anyone has touched on it.
Do you have thoughts, Melanie, on the role of the imagination in non-Western science? You teased us with this.
I know, but I'm very, very ignorant myself on this topic. All I could say is I would assume, and please, if anyone in the audience would like to come in on this and rescue me, I'd be very grateful. But I think we have seen that real historical specificity around ideas of the imagination and of a particular kind of scientific approach. And so I am absolutely positive that there are different models for what the imagination is, if we look across different historical and contemporary cultures, and also how that interacts with explorations of nature and the universe, whether you call that science or not.
Great, and let's take another question from further back, yes, the middle of the central block there.
Hi, I just wondered if the panel could address one of the questions in the programme, which I haven't got onto yet, which is can a story or a narrative be a scientific explanation? Mm.
Can you quite hear the question?
So a story or narrative?
Can a story or a narrative be a scientific explanation?
Yeah. Yes. I think so.
Well, what's the example you have in mind?
I'm thinking, I guess, of my corpus of texts I work mainly on, which are educational texts, and often there is the use of quite explicit narrative devices to educate. So I'm thinking, for instance, of a book called In the Sky Garden, which is a brilliant astronomy book by Elizabeth Champney from the late 19th century. It's got a beautiful title and fantastic illustrations, and it's explicitly a pedagogic text, not merely pedagogic. I take issue with the mere pedagogy that I mentioned earlier as well. But it is explicitly teaching about astronomy, and it is all written as a one narrative, the whole book, but then within that, smaller stories about the names of the constellations and sort of the histories of astronomy and how that is. Off the top of my head, that's one example. But I would say absolutely that is an explanation of astronomy, and it is written quite explicitly as a narrative. I also think that there's narrative structures and forms at play within all scientific writing, and so any piece of, for instance, a journal can be assessed narratologically and has within it a certain element of telling the story of that experiment.
There are members of the audience here who have worked on the concept of narratives.
Are working.
In science. Yeah.
I mean, presumably when the target of explanation is itself a very specific event, like the extinction of the dinosaurs, say, the explanation will explicitly be a narrative account of what happened, when the asteroid hit,
once
what it
upon
caused.
A time.
Yeah, it will be very specifically a chronological narrative.
I just thought of this. So there's a current view of explanation in the philosophy of science, right, which is sort of called counterfactual view. Mm. Yeah. You explain something by saying, well, what if these conditions had been different? Would we have got the same phenomenon, right? Yeah. And there you've got both a narrative. You don't have to think of that in terms of logical deduction. You can think of it as just giving a narrative. You explain the formation of rainbows in the following way. You give a narrative. But then you've got that what-if component that people like James Woodward and others emphasise, where you imagine the conditions, initial conditions being different. So you've got a combination of imagination and narrative. I mean, you could hope people don't think I'm sort of shoehorning everything fits into the imagination one way or another. I'll make it fit. But I mean, I think you can see that form of explanation that people are talking about now as in terms of imagination plus narrative in that way.
That explanation is fundamentally about trying to give a account of why things are this way and not a different
not
way.
Not a different way, yeah.
Where
yeah.
the imagining of the different yeah. way is central to yeah. all explanations.
Yeah.
And I feel we talked a lot about logic, and I think within the term narrative there's a sort of directionality, an order in which things happen, a beginning, yeah. a middle, and an end. And I think you see that at play at different levels throughout yeah. various yeah. examples that we've talked about.
Yeah, and it relates back to what you were saying before. Instead of just being provided with a message, you're given an opportunity to work through something, yes. which can help with aid understanding.
Certainly that example of Einstein's clocks and you compared to Dickens, the styles there, so similar.
Yeah.
You can literally read Einstein as describing a narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he really does when he takes you through. Imagine this, now imagine that, now imagine the following. It can be set in that narrative form.
But yeah. again, I think if we're looking at that rupture from 19th to 20th yeah. century, we see the move from a realist narrative to modernist narrative forms, which are very much trying to disrupt some of those
yeah.
ideas. And across yeah. Einstein's lifetime, just as you chronicled, yeah. you yeah. also see this shift from yeah. the sort of immediately sensory, the world of the patent office, to the wibbly wobbly space time. I've caught the
international
the universal
science.
And I think that's something that is interesting, what quantum yep. physics and relativistic physics does to our notions of absolute space time, and alongside that, what it means to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, because time itself is so fundamentally rethought. Really fascinating.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Thanks very much to all three of you for these fantastic examples. I think we've seen quite a lot about the various different roles that the imagination can play in science. So let's thank our panelists for a very interesting discussion.